Caught Offside with Andrew Gundling and JJ Devaney.
Oh, yes. Caught Offside from the Upper West Side of Manhattan. Andrew Gundling. JJ Devaney, what's up, brother?
I'm good.
Glad to hear it.
I'm a bit disappointed in you, though.
Of course you are. Why wouldn't you be?
Well, we mentioned our kind of what we're watching right now on TV, you know, all the various shows we watch, and you turned me on to Escape at Dannemora.
Yeah.
Which I've been watching and really enjoying.
It's great.
I think it's fascinating. And you told me that you saw Ben Stiller on the street.
I was driving into work right near the ESPN station where we're at, and I was at a red light, and I look over to my right, and waiting to cross the street at the street corner is Ben Stiller. I couldn't believe it.
And you wouldn't, you see, that's wasted on you.
What does that mean?
I would have, Ben, thumbs up, just like that.
Great.
Just do it.
But it's wasted on me. So what did you accomplish by giving Ben a thumbs up?
I'm trying to think of the last celebrity interaction I had. I always make sure.
First of all, I was in my car. So you're saying I should have rolled down my window, shouted out the window.
Oh, you were
just to give him a thumbs up.
Yeah. No, you can't do that from the car.
No, if I was walking down the street and happened to just like be at the corner with him, I'd say, by the way, Escape at Dannemora is phenomenal. I'm really enjoying it.
I met Jimmy Norton, the comedian.
Oh, big fan.
On the platform at 66th Street and Lincoln Center.
Okay.
And I just said, went over him straight away, stuck the hand out and said, big fan of yours. And I said, I was just listening to your thing with Jeter, where you went to the Derek Jeter appreciation night or whatever it was.
Uh-huh.
I said, I can't stop laughing. And he goes, thanks very much, appreciate it. And you know, I was just like two celebrity planets colliding, Devaney and Norton. And the respect was just oozing between us. I can't even be
serious. You are a disgrace.
I told you about Jake Gyllenhaal, right?
No.
The first year I was out here, I did a little bit of on-site work for a Canelo fight.
Okay.
And I was with Max Kellerman. And my job was to get into the ring straight afterwards.
You were the ring girl.
But I did have to hold something up. I had to hold up the monitor for Kellerman. And right beside me, I was ringside because I had to be in really quickly.
They don't have a stool or a table that does that. They ask a person to hold the monitor.
You're a moron.
Okay.
Will you listen to me? You don't know
Seems
how...
Seems like an overreaction.
You don't know how the business works.
Okay. Tell me more about the business.
So at HBO, what we did was we had to get into the ring and hold the monitor for him because there's all these people crowding around him, photographers, everybody. And so Kellerman has to see where he is in terms of the camera. So I hold up the monitor. That shows him, right, that he's in shot. The whole thing. And that was my job. And I was like, yeah, I'm doing that. In the middle of the ring at the Garden. Come on.
Okay.
Unbelievable.
I'm still surprised that a person does that, but nevertheless.
So I'm ringside and I'm in a seat. And I'm told, JJ, you'll have to get up in about 20 minutes. Mr. Gyllenhaal will be here. And he was rehearsing for Southpaw, that film he did.
Uh-huh.
And he was... Sorry, researching, not rehearsing. Mm-hmm. But he was trying to get into the whole thing and wanted to be close. I was so close, I had Canelo spit down the side of my face.
Oh.
Unbelievable.
Haven't showered since, trust me.
So,
I can all tell.
So, yeah. So that was, Gyllenhaal comes in, I get out, and I said, I kept it warm for you, Jake.
Is he the biggest celebrity you've ever had, like, interaction with?
Kate Moss. She count?
I suppose she does. She certainly counts. I don't know if I'd say that she's bigger necessarily than, I don't know. That's a good question.
Mm.
They're both. If that's the best you can do, I'll be honest, that's a little disappointing. I played volleyball with Jay-Z on a beach in the Dominican Republic. Bang.
We can't do this story now, but it is.
No.
We should do it on the Christmas special.
Oh,
it's unbelievable.
We have so much to get to soccer-wise on this podcast.
Soccer?
A big midweek EPL recap. Interesting game at Old Trafford, United and Arsenal. We'll talk about that in mere moments. JJ, the MLS Cup final. It's here.
It's upon us.
The season will come to its resolution this Saturday night, 8 o'clock Eastern Time in Atlanta. And we have this completely covered for all of you. We've got a guest from both the Atlanta side of things and the Portland side of things. Kevin Egan, the commentator for Atlanta United FC, will join us. And Ross Smith, an analyst for the Portland Timbers on TV, he will join us as well. So we'll get both sides of this. You will be completely ready and prepared for the final after hearing that. Look back at Greg Berhalter's introductory press conference, which I thought, we'll talk about it when we get there.
And, it was whelming. I wasn't underwhelmed. I wasn't overwhelmed. I was whelmed.
I thought he said the right things. Like, I don't, if you walked away from that and you were like, and you were thinking, well, we're doomed, like, then get a grip, I would say to people who have that opinion. And then, of course, red card man of the match. I'm very, feeling very good about my red card. I think you're going to like it as well.
Okay.
But as I mentioned, we'll start with the Premier League. You told me that somebody had the nerve to tweet you because you always send out like a Twitter blast of what's going to be coming up on our podcast, and you didn't mention that we were going to be talking Premier League. You just mentioned MLS Cup, Bearhalter, whatever, and somebody said, Are you going to be talking Premier League?
But you'll mention the midweek games, right?
Like, what in our past on this podcast would lead you to believe that we would just fail to mention the Premier League?
We're so Anglo-centric, it's unbelievable.
It's ridiculous. And of course, and we do it right now, Manchester United and Arsenal 2-2 is your final. And JJ, an interesting theme is developing with Manchester United, one that we've talked about on this podcast.
Toxicity?
Well, yes.
Virus?
All of those things. But what... Like, in an atmosphere of toxicity, what's the one thing that you wouldn't really anticipate that atmosphere also encompassing?
Joy.
Resiliency. But all this... Look at Manchester United. So they came back twice in this match. They trailed 1-0, tied at 1-1, trailed 2-1, and then immediately, less than 2 minutes later, tied it up at 2. I was just going back through their recent run of results. Obviously, they came back from 2 down over the weekend against Southampton. They came back in the Champions League to beat Juve from 1-0 down, won that 2-1. Came back to beat Bournemouth. Came back from a goal down against Chelsea, although Chelsea then did score in the 96th to re-equalize. But still, came back from 2 down in that game against Newcastle, which a lot of people think may have saved Jose Mourinho's job. I'm not trying to draw a grand conclusion from it. I'm just saying, in a season of such intense negativity surrounding that club, it's a strange anomaly. It's not a characteristic that you would expect a club in the position that they're in right now, with a manager that people think they don't want to play for. It's not a characteristic you would expect them to have.
True, but it's not a characteristic of Manchester United to go down to teams that are as poor as that. And it's not a characteristic of a Manchester United team to be clawing a 1-0 victory at home against Young Boys Bern. It's not a characteristic of Manchester United to go to a team that cannot beat anyone and certainly cannot hold on to a lead and be down 2-0 as they were at Southampton. Claw the game back to 2-2 at half time, by the way, and not win the game with 45 minutes. Like, this is... You're right. I'm surprised with everything that's happening in this club, both on the field, both in terms of team selection, both in terms of the falling out with key players by the manager. It is surprising that they've somehow held their heads above water. But the water line is Bournemouth. They're struggling to stay in touch with Bournemouth.
But what's interesting to me is, so it's bad right now for United. There's no way around that. Think of how bad it could be if they didn't have that trait in them to be able to not get discouraged from going 2 down at St. Mary's, going down twice against Arsenal. They could be lower, like bottom half of the table.
But they have to go. They have to go down to come back up. You've seen those games. They don't play with any freedom or abandon until the game plan is completely gone and they're 2-0 down, as witnessed against Newcastle, as witnessed against... I would say as witnessed against Juventus.
Southampton maybe.
Southampton
also,
to an extent, although, I mean, it was in Southampton's DNA to give up that lead. It's just such thin gruel. We're just grasping at straws here with this team. This is...
Well, you demand to be negative when talking about them.
I am trying to find a positive side, and you said,
but they trailed against Bournemouth. Well,
That's not fair. And you know what? Even going into yesterday's game against Arsenal, I thought, because I'm conditioned by what I used to see in the 1990s, I was saying they'll win this. They'll actually win this. Doesn't matter how wretched they've been, the coalescence of the Mourinho-style ability to beat the big boys and the United never say die will come together, and somehow they'll win it. And, well, I wasn't right, but 2-2. I don't know. It was a weird game. There wasn't a good goal in it. There wasn't one goal where you said that was a piece of quality. They were all flawed, mistake-ridden goals, and it was a far cry from United Arsenal of yore. That's for sure.
Yeah, moments I guess of suspect defending. I thought Rob Holding ended up leaving early, but like the first goal that United scored. I've seen the replay so many times, and I just keep thinking, how does that ball get through?
Yeah,
to the position.
It's Ander Herrera who ran in and centered it.
Right,
and it was Martial who drove it past Torreira, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah, it was. And but I still don't know how that ball wasn't cleared. And there was a little bit of criticism for Leno, but I don't know how. I mean, he saved the free kick and he pushed it far away. It was really just awareness from Ander Herrera to chase it down. Ander Herrera was peeling off the wall as the free kick was hit for anything that might break. So it was well done to him, really.
Yeah, but you had the Mustafi goal, which, like, you look, it's asking a lot of David De Gea, but I don't know, we kind of know him too.
What? What's it asking of him? Yeah. That is basic from him.
Yeah.
And also, Herrera on the line, he completely believed that De Gea would catch it, that he wasn't ready, and he went for the ball with his foot when really he probably should have thrown his head at it. And then look at the Rojo mistake, the Rojo own goal. He gives the ball up, he chases it back down, and then he ends up kicking it into his own net.
Yeah.
It was a farce of a game, really.
Yeah.
It was. And you know what? That used to be the compelling fixture. That was one of those fixtures that you were late 90s into the early noughties. You had to watch it. You had to be at a TV. But that's because both protagonists were, one was at the top of their game in Manchester United. Arsenal were nipping at their heels all the time, if not leading the league. It's just fallen so way short of that now.
Yeah, and that's kind of a segue into just like the general state of things. I was reading an article from Phil McNulty online, and he was talking about the Manchester United support at Old Trafford and how when the game ended 2-2, a draw at home, the crowd applauded. And he's saying that's a sign that maybe a new – I'm paraphrasing. He didn't use these words, but that like a new normal is developing among the Manchester United fan base, that the bar has now been lowered when a 2-2 draw at home – is not necessarily a thing that United fans would applaud in the past.
No, but I would say this. They were shorn of their stars for most of that game. This was the cast-offs. It wasn't like Mata played. It wasn't like Pogba played or started. Sanchez wasn't even in the squad. It was kind of like Fred wasn't even in the squad. The fourth most expensive Manchester United player of all time was not in the squad. And so this was kind of guys who were yeah, like I said, cast-offs. And they started and they played well and they showed the spirit and the fight that the manager demanded in some very pointed pre-match notes, who basically said, I need to see the spirit and I need to see certain traits that you don't have, Paul Pogba, are not exhibiting for the cause, for the team. So I think they were probably applauding that, and maybe the spin that Mourinho has put on this season, which is, what can I do with these guys? What do you want from me? Just look at them. Maybe the fans are responding to that.
I think the fans are stuck right now. I was watching ESPN FC, and I think it was Burley and Nicol that were talking about how, like, look what went on at Arsenal in the final days of Wenger. Planes flying overhead, protests. Like, there was, you can, I don't know what side of it you fall on. You can say it was misguided. You can say it was justified. But whatever it was passionate. But with Manchester United, I don't know what the fans feel about Jose Mourinho or Pogba. Like, do they hate these guys? Are they ambivalent towards them? Do they support them? Like, I don't really know if United, as a fan base, I don't always expect every fan to agree with the guy next to him, but it doesn't feel like there's a clear message on how Manchester United supporters feel about this team.
There was a plane that flew over, but it wasn't for Wenger.
It was for Woodward.
It was for Woodward.
But
it wasn't for Mourinho.
I guess I would say that I'm genuinely surprised that there is not more fan outrage from Manchester United supporters over Jose Mourinho.
I think they've kind of accepted the position they're in. They look at the top, they look at the Glazers, who are not football people. They have a board that has no director of football on it. There is no direct sporting director. There is a non-football person who has opened the purse strings in Ed Woodward. His job is recruitment. Mm-hmm. And they look at Jose Mourinho as this guy just stuck in this dysfunctional system. When in actual fact, you look at the signings that they've made over the last few years, that just doesn't work. Mourinho does have the tools to be producing much better than he has, but he's constantly deflected towards the players. Look at even his emissary in the media, Duncan Castles. Duncan Castles has an article straight away about how Mourinho confronted Paul Pogba in the dressing room after the Southampton game and called him a virus. So Mourinho has spread this kind of I wouldn't call it a myth because Pogba's performance was very poor at Southampton, but this kind of narrative that the players are the problem.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
And it seems to have worked. It's caught traction amongst the United fans who are now... I mean, we do remember United Fan TV guys shouting about the way, the style of play. I haven't heard much about the style of play since, even though that is the problem.
You know, one thing that's interesting to me, and I'm kind of looking it up on the fly, you mentioned the Glazers, these non-football people. You know, they become, and maybe Woodward has taken some of the burden off of them, but they become a punching bag for a lot of United support, for a lot of pundits. You know, like, we're almost excusing Manchester United for being where they are because they are in some way having something to do with this.
Well, no,
like,
that goes back.
The Glazers took over fully. They bought out Manchester United and took full ownership in, I think, in around 2005. JJ, since then, United have won 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. They've won 5 titles.
Yeah.
So that happened on their watch.
Yeah, what happened beforehand when they weren't mired in debt to various different banks? It goes deeper than that, Andrew, with the Glazers. The Glazers,
but to excuse United for being this like middling club because the Glazers are involved, I think is a little bit unfair. Look, they have spent. You can say that, you know, maybe they haven't spent wisely, but this isn't an ownership group that is unwilling to open up the purse to bring players in.
Listen, if you're asking me, do I think Mourinho should be doing more with the tools he's got? Absolutely, 100%. I believe that from just a footballing standpoint. But there are longer legacy issues going back to the buyout of the club from the Glazers that still remain. And they are a little bit behind in terms of, like I said, a director of football and creating that kind of culture that other clubs, namely one down the road, have done.
By the way, Arsenal, we should mention, they are unbeaten in their last 20 games, which is obviously under a new manager, that is a pretty amazing stat.
It's brilliant. It really is. And they are moving in the right direction. Make no mistake about it. Now, they definitely have to address that back three or back four or whatever. Whatever way he comes up with it, Andrew, those defenders aren't good enough. Straight from the kickoff, the way they were caught out, Kolasinac, it was ridiculous. That can't happen. 74 seconds. Mm-hmm. Not good enough. But I would say that it's going to really annoy Emery that he could have had the first victory since in the Premier League at Old Trafford since 2006. That's really going to annoy him, that didn't happen.
That it slipped
away in the fashion that it did.
Yeah, 20 unbeaten. It's amazing that they're fifth on a run like that.
It's true.
Like, you would think they'd be in the title conversation.
But you compare the way they're playing, the mood at the Emirates, the general attacking style, a player like Torreira who embodies everything the Arsenal fan thinks they haven't had since Patrick Vieira. Mm-hmm. And you can see that this is on an upswing.
Yeah. JJ, we move from that to Wolves and Chelsea. 2-1, it goes to Wolves. Their season has been so bizarre. Obviously, it got off to their really bright start where they were being lauded as maybe the greatest promoted team in Premier League history. And then they really hit the skids. Where they have 1 point from their previous 6 games leading up to this Chelsea match. And then they go and they host Chelsea and they win 2-1. They've had an incredible run of form against the big six in the Premier League so far this season. Lots of draws, this win over Chelsea. It's been against some of the lower sides that has really kind of given them trouble.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know how you explain that. I guess, you know, you have to be able to get up for everybody. It can't just be the big clubs that you're excited about facing.
And I think that would be, maybe subconsciously, that's part of it. Because Wolves now consider themselves a big club. They love the big day. They've bought players to reflect that. They've bought a goalkeeper who's maybe right now the best goalkeeper in the league. They've strengthened that midfield with Moutinho and players like that. You know, they went out with the very intention of establishing themselves as a permanent power in the Premier League. And I suppose with all that comes the responsibility of, you know, going and beating Huddersfield and teams like that. But they were pretty good, especially in the second half against Chelsea.
Well, they were, but that is only telling half the story. Chelsea were very good, I thought, in the first half. I mean, like, I don't know, it felt a little bit to me like one of those games where it's kind of unfair to look at it and say Chelsea are a mess right now.
No, I don't think
now,
so.
Now, Chelsea are in a poor run of form, but, you know, 17 shots in this one, 70% possession, I think Wolves had this great stretch in the second half where they were able to capitalize and take the lead.
Well, prior to the Wolves' comeback, Willian had a brilliant chance that was denied by a brilliant tackle by Ryan Bennett. Morata had a chance that you got to feel when he's on form, he gets to
and
that
when
ball.
When is that?
Yeah, exactly. And Hazard, who hasn't scored in 7 or 8 games for them now, he had a good chance as well, and it was just this lame shot that Patricio dealt with easily. And look, there's a couple of factors coming together to explain why Chelsea are where they are, in my view. Hazard, quietly, he slipped into this goal drought. Morata continues to struggle, and the centre-forward position is not solidified at the club, and they need to address it. And the midfield, Sarri started Fabregas in the centre of the park, rested Jorginho, and it didn't work. Like, for if you look at the Wolves' equaliser, Fabregas was held off the ball by an 18-year-old, Gibbs White, in a position right in front of that Chelsea defence. That can't happen. And you're just wondering, where's Kante right now? That is someone who would that would just simply wouldn't happen to. And he plays one pass, Jimenez is in, and it's the equaliser. Sarri needs to find a way to get Kante back to doing what he's best at doing and still incorporate Jorginho's tempo setting and his passing. That is the conundrum for Chelsea right now, in my view.
Yeah, and we also, to go back to Morata on that, we talked a little bit last week about Eden Hazard's difficulty, it seems, in playing along with Alvaro Morata. And look, I mean, there's a lot of important players on that team. Obviously, Jorginho and N'Golo Kante may be chiefly among them, but none more so than Eden Hazard. And I think Sarri has to start to set up his team in a way that will bring the best out of Hazard. And if that means Morata having to go to the bench and bring Olivier Giroud in, I think you have to start doing that. If Morata's just, he's not giving you anything. So if he's not scoring goals, and for whatever reason, his style of play is not conducive to Hazard, then what are you waiting for?
Also, Loftus-Cheek, Fabregas, and Kante as a midfield three, it just doesn't work. It seems unbalanced. And but they're not. They started so well, and we felt as if they clicked into gear under Sarri so quickly that we were maybe lulled into a false sense of security. Like we said before, they were giving up really good quality chances to teams in an unbelievable fashion, and this was in the mail. But we probably didn't expect it was going to be Wolves that would deliver their second defeat in a row.
No. And we move from that, JJ, to Burnley and Liverpool, which ends 3-1. Liverpool coming from a goal down, scoring 3 straight. They win that one, but not without at least somewhat of a loss. Now, Jurgen Klopp spoke after this match about, I guess, an overly aggressive Burnley. And he doesn't necessarily put the onus on Burnley to not play that way. He puts the onus on the official to kind of rein Burnley in from playing that way. Here is what Klopp said after the match.
I said after the first challenge, I don't know who did it, like sliding tackling of 6-7 yards, coming in, getting the ball, everybody likes it. I said to the ref, please, just maybe it was no foul, but please tell them you cannot do that. Because nobody can judge that. Eh? Nobody, you get the ball, nice, but you always, it's like bowling. Because you get the other one, the player as well. And then that's exactly what happened in the left corner. It was 4 or 5 times. Everyone, no foul. Everybody likes it, stuff. But you have to be careful in that in circumstances like that. Joe is injured. And probably not only a little bit. We have to see that. We don't know it in a moment. We send him home. And we have to see tomorrow. But that's
the ankle.
Yeah. That we have to see. But it's ankle, yes.
And that has now come back that he fractured his leg. And
6 weeks minimum.
Right. Which is unfortunate for a guy having a breakout season for Liverpool.
Yeah.
And with an important Champions League match on the horizon.
Yeah. But what do you do? Do you outlaw sliding tackles? Do you know, the minute I saw Burnley and I saw that coating of water on top of the surface.
Yeah, it's like a slip and slide.
You know, Burnley are in a dogfight. You know they're going to get in, they're going to press, they're going to tackle. Phil Bardsley, his stock and trade is those kind of tackles. Ben Mee's tackle on Gomez was a good tackle. That's what Liverpool fans probably don't want to hear. He's taken the ball. Now, I agree with Klopp. When you slide 6-7 yards away, even if you get the ball, you go through the player. That is the problem. But what are you going to do? Outlaw the sliding tackle. The best tackle of the night in England was Ryan Bennett on Willian. He got the ball, but because he's gone to ground and because of his momentum, He's also clattered Willian. So I don't know what you do there. One of the staples of the Premier League, the reason we watch the game, is the sliding tackle. It is an exciting thing, and it was associated with the blood and thunder of English football. But there is collateral damage when you win the ball and go through someone. Now, do I think you know the way I often talk about leaving one on someone, where you're definitely getting the ball, but I'm going to leave my foot in. I don't think Mee did that. Now, did Bardsley do that? He did that once. But the rest of the tackles from who else was that other tackle? I can't remember who it was. But there was an excellent tackle on Salah, sliding tackle too. You can't ask the referee to tell the players, don't go to ground. The only thing you can ask the referee is to make sure it's not undue force, that you're endangering a player.
Fouls were 10-3, Burnley, obviously. Only one yellow card. I guess if you're Klopp, maybe that's the one. Like, nobody's saying outlaw sliding tackles, but of those 10 fouls, only one yellow was given. Maybe Klopp thinks, look, at least give me another one or two just to send some kind of message.
Yeah, no, I don't disagree with him in assessing that there is danger when players go to the ground like that, but that is just not going out with the English game.
Yeah, and you're right, nor should it. But were you... when you go down in the 54th minute and you know it's Burnley and you know Liverpool have
something of a difficult history,
playing there, are you worried?
I was worried. I was very worried. And the substitutions needed to be made because it just wasn't happening. Now, there was huge squad rotation. Klopp recognised we are going into a busy period now. He's probably looking towards Napoli at home next week. And I was worried because Burnley were really up for it. And Burnley had the better chances up until that point. But, I mean, the third goal in particular was just a fabulous goal.
There were some people that had an issue with the lineup that Klopp put out there.
I didn't.
Me neither. Like, you are getting to a point in the season where you do kind of need to prioritize a little bit match for match. We just talked about it last week with what we saw with Pochettino and Spurs in a busy week of fixtures. And Liverpool are coming into the same kind of thing. They've got Napoli coming up. They've got Manchester United. They've got Bournemouth this weekend who have been good. I mean, this is a tough stretch with a lot of matches in a tight window. And Burnley have struggled this year. So if you think there's a spot to give your team, some guys on your team a breath, then I'm okay with it.
You have to take it. It's not like Manchester United's rotation would seem to be like, oh, sack me, please. Find a way to sack me.
Yeah, so it's a good result for Liverpool, and say what you want, Manchester City continue to dominate, although Watford this match on Tuesday wasn't quite the dominant version of City that we've gotten to know. They were a little wasteful with some of their chances.
But again,
it could have been worse,
but again,
they win.
They arrested players too.
Yeah,
so.
Yeah, they absolutely did. But Liverpool are hanging in there. They are giving us a title race maybe longer than some people might have thought. I'll tell you what, we're going to take a very, very quick break, so please don't go away. Then when we come back, we'll do a little MLS Cup final preview with both Kevin Egan and Ross Smith. We'll do a little Greg Berhalter. We got a little what to watch for. Red cards, man of the match. Oh, the fun. The fun, JJ. It never ends. Don't go anywhere. Oh, back now on Caught Offside. All right, JJ, here we go. It's been many, many months in the making. And finally, it is upon us, MLS Cup 2018. The final is here. It's going to be in Atlanta, of course, this Saturday. We've got both sides covered. We're going to talk with Kevin Egan in just a moment, commentator for Atlanta United FC. But before that, we're going to go out west. Well, not really, because he's already in Atlanta. So out west and then back east to Ross Smith, analyst for the Portland Timbers. And he joins us right now from Atlanta. Ross, what's up, man? How are you?
Good to hear you guys. Pleasure to be on your show for the first time. Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, I know. This is exciting. Exciting circumstances as you got the final coming up this Saturday. I want to go back to the beginning of the season for Portland. And JJ and I have talked a lot about this. They got off to such a rough start, and then they turned it around. And I'm curious if there was a specific moment somewhere along the way between that rough start and between where we are now where you looked at this team and thought, yeah, this is possible. This team could wind up in MLS Cup final?
Yeah, it's a good question. I look back at the start of the season and even in the preseason, Andrew, and for my time, since being the broadcaster for the Timbers, it's been under Caleb Porter. And so getting used to Caleb Porter's ways and how things operate during preseason, it was obviously different. The new manager coming in, different ideas. And he had a tough task of having to pick up a team, pick up the baton of a winning side who had looked after Western Conference last year, much of the same players, or the core at least, and get them to buy in. And I think preseason, when you go all the way back to that period, there was fresh new faces coming into the team. But it was all about those old Timbers, and the old Timbers to the new Timbers, trying to find the bridge, trying to mesh those two parties together. And I think the managers struggled with that in preseason, going into the season. And so to answer your question, I thought after the second game of the season against the Red Bulls to the third game of the season against FC Dallas, the first two games weren't good for the Timbers, and the second game wasn't good at all. We were on the broadcast and doing our post-game. Gio's come on, and he's thrown down the headset, and he's upset. Mm. And we thought, geez, he's going in there, the hairdryer treatment into the change room. But the difference he showed from the second to the third game in the tactics, I thought, was his differences that we've seen in the manager. And he started to get the buy-in. He went to this Christmas tree formation we've never seen in a Timbers kit, with them going in, and he just stabilized things. So that was one moment where a big change happened. And the second one was when he went back to the 4-2-3-1. And I say back to the 4-2-3-1. That was during the Caleb Porter era, what won him the cup in 2015. And that was with three games to go against Real Salt Lake. And so for all their success that they had, 15 games unbeaten, I never screamed to you that they were difficult to beat, but the brand of soccer that I've been accustomed to was a team that was exhilarating going forward and in the attack. And so that was the game on itself, three games to go, where I thought, this is a team now. This is a team in that 4-2-3-1, Diego Char in the center of the pitch, Blanco out wide, Valeri back to having the number 10 position all to himself. This was a team that could go and compete. So those two moments for me stood out.
Ross, talking about Valeri and Blanco, I think... I wouldn't say Blanco's flown under the radar for those of us who have watched him, but how important has he been in terms of, you know, sharing the creative workload with Diego Valeri?
Yeah, massively. Massively. I thought last year when he came in, he was good. But this year there was something different, and for him to have a full preseason under himself to know what the system was all about, you've seen a difference. And he's a guy that can be the main man, and if Valeri's not doing it, he doesn't mind stepping up. The thing that stands out to me, I think it was so obvious in the Kansas City game. Blanco wasn't good in the first half, but he's okay with it, and he doesn't go hiding. He doesn't go missing. And I think that's signs for a youngster or for a player with not big experience or for a player who doesn't believe in themselves. They could easily go missing in a match like that. And we all know the goal that he scored, the screamer that he scored. And so all of a sudden, with Blanco now and this time he's coming as a Timber, where you could concentrate on Diego Valeri before and you could try and figure Valeri out if teams, you know, do. But if you concentrate fully on him, you got a Blanco who can pop up and he can score a screamer. He can score a belter like what he did. And he's got the confidence in himself. So even when the chips are down, he can find a moment. And so I think that's been huge for the Timbers to be able to have for Valeri. And you look at last year, what Valeri did, MVP of the league. He needed somebody else to come in and produce and turn a game. And so it's been huge. It opens things up now. So if you look after Blanco, well, you got Valeri popping up and vice versa. So he's been huge. His character is big. You can imagine he gets under the skin of opponents.
Yeah.
But he's such a lovely guy off the pitch. But when he steps on the pitch, he's nasty. And I think that's what every teammate wants in a Blanco, in a player like that, that you hate him if you're against him. You love him if he's with you.
Ross Smith joining us here on Caught Offside, talking some Portland Timbers. Ross, I'm curious about Jeremy Abobase. Now, you may know the numbers off the top of your head, but he's played in something like 14 matches, and their win rate when he plays is through the roof. Now, I'm curious from you, is that just some sort of like anomaly, or what is it about him that seems to have like really instilled a winning way within this club?
Yeah, I think you have to go back to last year. He was given a chance when the Timbers were depleted up at BC Place against Vancouver, and Caleb Porter picked him. He had to pick him. He didn't really have any other choice. And Abobase did so well, and he started to fulfill the expectations that everybody was putting on him to be the next up-and-coming striker. But then a couple games later, Caleb Porter gave him a start again against the Red Bulls at home, and he went missing. He didn't have a good game, and he was played out of the starting lineup, and he didn't really get a look after it. And so for him coming in, when Sammy Armenteros, he had a few little injuries, he went back home for personal reasons. it was a Bobatisse turn again. And so his desperation that he showed, recognizing that he lost it last year, the desperation he showed to take advantage of the moment, the opportunity, I think really stood out. But the most impressive thing about him was his hold up play. And he had to be on the same level as a Blanco and Valeri. And I think back to the Timbers again under Caleb Porter. They were known for being able to play it into a striker like Fernando Adi. And he had Nagby coming underneath Valeri. And all of a sudden now defenses, they couldn't deal with the pace of it, the quickness in the mind of the play. Bobasi had to be at that level. And I've never seen it out of Bobasi until he got this run of games. And so it's no surprise to me now, him coming in and what he has shown when the ball goes into him, the quickness of the mind to understand where's Valeri, where's Blanco, how can I play it into him, even Chara, his thrust out of midfield. And so it's no wonder that success. I think it's also helped with the Timbers going into the 4-2-3-1, and Bobasi has been given that chance as well. It just feels as though everybody's in the most natural position and the position that they can excel in. And so the records, it's not a huge surprise with it, because Bobasi fits well in that solo lone striker role with all these guys coming underneath him.
Ross, can I ask a question about the fans, the Portland Timbers fans? So the Timbers Army, prior to the introduction of Atlanta United to MLS, the Timbers Army kind of occupied this space as somebody, an outsider, could look at and see this fan base. It was vibrant. It was inclusive. Yeah. It still is. I say was. It still is. And it's got this, it was almost famous in Europe. You play in an old baseball stadium. You were an old NASL team. You have all that going for you. You were like the culture club. And now Atlanta comes in with their swagger and their new stadium. And look, oh, Waka Flocka, he's there, or whoever he is, some rapping big boy, and all the rappers, all the hip hop guys, all the hippity hop guys. So what I'm saying is, there a chip on the shoulder of the Timbers fans that people are kind of focusing on the fan culture at Atlanta a little bit more now, and you know, the Timbers Army are there. Hey, listen, we're the OGs, we're the original guys, we are the proper supporters. Is there that kind of vibe, or am I just making stuff up?
I don't think so. I'd imagine at some point there would have been, but I think what it falls back on, if you want to go to a concert and see one of your favorite artists, one of your favorite singers, you don't want to go to some cavernous stadium where you're miles away. You want to be in an intimate scenario where you feel like you're personally invited. And I think that's what they fall back on. So I imagine it must have been when all the glitz and glamour of big teams like in Atlanta United come in. The fans in Portland will feel as though there's that immediate connection, and the way that the stadium is set up, it's obviously going through refurbishments now to increase the capacity by 4,000. They feel on top of it. They feel that they're right there. And You compare that, and I'm interested because I haven't been in Mercedes-Benz Stadium to see a game live, so I'm interested to see what it feels like. But I do compare it to Seattle. I'm not being biased here for the rivalry, but there's a different feel from Seattle and from Portland, and you go towards Portland and you come away from it thinking, I experienced it. There was something that I was a part of, from the national anthem, the TIFOs that go up. So I think it must have been when Timbers Army and all these TIFOs that are coming up now and everything, and the crowds and the supporters group, they must have felt like, oh, we were the ones who started. I'm sure there was those conversations in the background. But for the reasons that I've said there, I feel as though they feel they have something precious there. And I don't know how much your listeners will know about this, but for a home game for the Timbers during regular season alone, fans will start lining up 24 hours at a minimum before the game. And they already have tickets for a general admittance area. They want to be the first in. And so they're camping out on concrete to be able to be the first ones in. And for a playoff game, you can get up to 48 hours before a game that they're camping out. So they feel they have something special there. There's a bond between the fans. There's a bond between the fans and the players.
Oh, I love it.
It does. So cool. It does look amazing. I got to give Portland its due. It looks organic. It looks real, and I got to get there.
Yeah, good stuff. Hey, Ross, we really appreciate the time. I know these are busy days. You're in Atlanta. Enjoy the final. Enjoy the city, and maybe we'll catch up after the match is over. Thanks, man.
Yeah, for sure. Appreciate you guys having me on. Look forward to meeting you in person along the way.
Oh, our thanks to Ross. Wants to meet up in person, JJ. I don't know. We're not really that fun.
I would meet up with Ross. It would be fine. It would be cordial. We'd have banter. We'd get on fine. You would
Should
be,
he be part of it. What is this you call it? Our Beers with Buds program or whatever?
Pints with Pals.
Oh, that's it's right. Already... I like Beers with Buds, to be honest.
Well, okay, fine. You can sit in the corner and you can do your own segment.
Yeah, maybe I will. And maybe I'll do it with Kevin Egan as we go from Portland side of things to Atlanta's side of things. Kevin, of course, commentator for Atlanta United FC. You see him on BN Sports as well. And he is kind enough to join us now. Kevin, what's up, man? How are you?
I'm great. I'm trying to come up with my own one. So you've got Pints with Pals. You've got, what have you got, Beers with Bros? What was the other one?
Beers with Buds, although Bros is probably cooler.
Buds. Yeah. No, Buds is cooler, I think. Yeah, Bros is a bit too barstool. Gargle with Gents.
That's not bad. That could work. By the way, Kevin, Andrew says this. He has no intention of following through.
Why?
Well, first of all, Kevin is from Ireland too. And the last thing, your biggest nightmare would be to be spending time with another Irishman outside of me.
Where do you get that from? I tell you all the time on my trip to Dublin and Ireland. It was one of the most fun trips I've ever had. How dare you cast aspersions?
I feel like this has derailed the conversation somewhat.
Yeah, what we wanted to talk about was MLS Cup Final and the Atlanta United FC side of things. Kevin, let's go all the way back to the beginning with this club. How did they do this? How did they build such a great club so quickly?
I think it percolated through from Arthur Blank. So you find an incredibly ambitious owner, someone who's the owner of the Falcons, who's a winner, who's a New Yorker, who's just a hardened human being who's had great success in business with the likes of Home Depot and other companies that he has. He wanted to get involved in soccer. He had a lot of people tell him that Atlanta wasn't going to work because of the history of sports in Atlanta, and there hasn't been a championship team there since 1995. Now, they've had an underlying soccer culture there and a bit of an underground soccer culture there for a long time. The Atlanta Chiefs, 50 years ago this week, beat Manchester City in a game, and they were also a champion here within the U.S. In a lesser-known league. But Atlanta has been a huge success because Arthur Blank went about hiring the right people, I think. So we started with Darren Eales, the president of the team, who was involved in bringing Mauricio Pochettino to Spurs, and making some big decisions at Tottenham Hotspur alongside Daniel Levy. Then you brought in Carlos Bocanegra alongside Paul McDonough, who's now with Miami, Inter Miami, for next season, the year after that, sorry. And then some other big decisions at the club as well. But the biggest one, I think, is Tata Martino, because you bring in him, then all of a sudden you have the cachet, you've got the charisma to go out into the market and convince Miguel Almirón, who's got options over in Europe, to convince Joseph Martinez to go from Europe back to North America and play, and you go and get it done. And aside from that, the fan base has been spectacular too, and they've simply bought into the promise of young players producing rather than the big name stars that are kind of past their best.
Kevin, you talk about the big name stars, and I'm looking at this game. And I spoke to you after the second leg of the Eastern Conference Finals at Red Bull Arena, and I was really impressed with the way that Atlanta found a different way to play under Tata Martino. They just needed to get a result, and they got it, and they were able to be compact. I'm trying to find reasons for an upset and for Portland to win this game. If you were to pick something outside of the stars, a weakness in this side, what would it be?
I think at times Atlanta can overcommit, JJ, and leave numbers at the back. And if they do that in this game, you're up against maybe the best counter-attacking side in the league. And Gio Savarese has had some issues at the start of the year. Then they go on a 15-game unbeaten run. And this side is very comfortable defending. I think they've got one of the best holding midfielders in the league in Diego Chara. But further forward, you have difference makers. And I think when you look through the years at sides that have won MLS Cup, whether it be last year, Jovinko, Josie Altidore, the season before that, you still had Clint Dempsey, Nico Lodero. You always have to have those big difference makers in the latter stages of the playoffs. And the Red Bulls didn't have that over the course of the two legs. And certainly, Sporting Kansas City, you looked for a little bit more from them and a little bit more class. But I think Atlanta, if truth be told, have too much for Portland and should have too much. And if they show up and play close to their potential, they should win this game. And I'm curious to see what Tata does with the team. My gut says he plays the same 11 that played the last couple of games against the Red Bulls, that kept the Red Bulls scoreless for about 190 minutes before that late goal and stoppage time in the second leg. If they can remain defensively solid with three at the back, they'll push their wing backs all the way forward. The one change I might see Tata implementing would be start Tito Villalba and go at Portland from the start. And what he would do then is, I think he'd take out Franco Escobar as a right wing back, play Julian Gressel there, because you've got the right foot of Gressel and the great delivery from Gressel, and he's just going to hug the touchline. But I have a good feeling he'll bring Villalba in off the bench and stick with the same 11.
Kevin, you talk about Tata Martino. We already know that he's leaving for Mexico. There's been this persistent talk about the futures of Joseph Martinez, Miguel Almiron. Is there any kind of underlying concern with Atlanta where if they don't win now, it could be tough getting back here again?
It's not discussed, Andrew, but I think you're spot on. And this is a conversation that should be had, because this is kind of a golden era very early on in Atlanta United's history. It's only the second season. It's hard to believe the impact they've had on MLS. But Tata's leaving. You're right to say that. Miguel Almiron is most certainly leaving, it seems, anyway. All the talk is that Miguel Almiron was 2 years and done at Atlanta United. Now, the replacement right now looks to almost certainly be Pity Martinez, who's playing for River Plate at the Santiago Bernabeu this weekend in the Copa Libertadores final. He's a classy player, but he's a completely different player. Now, the one person to benefit from this change, I would think, and I'm sure it's in their thought process when they're going out to hire a new manager, is Ezequiel Barco. He hasn't lived up to the hype. He costs $15 million, and he's someone who has tremendous ability, and at times you can see that. But he's a different player, and it's kind of the case of the square peg and round hole type thing. He doesn't really fit the... Atlanta seem to play this counter-attacking through possession. Pass the ball at the back, whether it's Leandro Gonzalez-Perez across to Parkhurst, wait for the pass to Darlington Nagbe, and then spring an attack when the opposition try and press them. And that's why I don't think Portland will press Atlanta. They'll sit off comfortably this weekend. And that tactic this season has suited Miguel Almiron. Gives him a chance to stretch the legs, use his pace. It suits Tito Villalba. And I just don't think it suits Ezequiel Barco. It's going to be a completely different look next year. And I think Atlanta United fans aren't really discussing that enough, but they certainly realise it.
Kevin, if you're a betting man, give us a score prediction. Obviously, you're going to back Atlanta to win it. I don't blame you, but could this one maybe go to extra time? How do you see it playing out?
Well, Timbers have never beaten Atlanta. Atlanta have never beaten the Timbers. 2-1 all draws in the two games so far. The big difference maker for me, I know it's not the sexy pick here, but it's Eric Rometty has made a massive difference. And you saw that, JJ, at Red Bull Arena last week.
Yep.
He's an absolute pit bull in midfield, and he gets from flank to flank to do what Carlos Carmona did last season. He's been a big reason why Atlanta United haven't lost a home game in 12 games. Since he's been at the team, they haven't lost at Mercedes-Benz Stadium. And I just think there's been a massive momentum shift since that loss on the final day of the regular season in Toronto. Miguel Almiron is back fit. Tata knows he's leaving after the game. I can see them coming together and blitzing, trying to blitz Portland early in the game. And I can see maybe a 3-1 victory for Atlanta.
Kevin, before we let you go, we were just talking with Ross Smith from analyst for the Portland Timbers about their side of things in terms of fan culture. I'm curious for the Atlanta side of that. Obviously, the fan culture there has become such a story with this club. If you're in Atlanta now, we're 2 days away from the final, is it obvious that there is a big game happening this weekend? Has the city just like completely consumed itself with this?
I would say if Atlanta win this game, there's going to be, I would think, some sort of celebration, a parade maybe on Monday. And they'll do it at Mercedes-Benz. They'll pack the place. The city is all over this team. And there are people like radio hosts, TV hosts, apologizing to fans for doubting that this could happen. And you've got the ones that kicked the ball from when they were toddlers that have grown up in the city. And there is a rich history of soccer within Atlanta, like I talked about earlier on, that just hasn't been publicized all that much. And there's the bandwagon fan that's just joined in right now. But it's remarkable to see how they've gotten behind this team. And I think that it's going to be unprecedented what we're going to see on Saturday. Mercedes-Benz, they're going to blow the roof off the place. And it's going to be enjoyable to see it in person. I think they'll get it done. And like we talked about, it'll be a new era that they'll have to kind of figure out within the next 2 months, because Atlanta United are in the CONCACAF Champions League in February.
Oh, man. Yeah.
Well, you've got a fan for life right here, Kevin. Andrew believes they're a great club already after two seasons, and he is firmly on the bandwagon.
Do you know what I'd say here, JJ, as well? The one thing that a lot of people in my office down in Miami are talking about with Atlanta, which I don't really consider that much because I just don't get caught by it, but the celebrity culture within Atlanta United. We did a poll recently around our whole office. Who are the coolest soccer teams, the coolest football teams on the planet. You're Liverpool, we're up there, JJ, but Atlanta United in our poll came in third. And what I mean by cool is just the likes of Big Boy, the likes of Waka Flocka. You know, you look at Evander Holyfield was out hanging around with LeBron James the other day, and he was spotted wearing an Atlanta United jersey. The kits look good. The stadium is savage. Everything about the movement right now, the fan culture, the manager is cool. There's just something about the team that just screams millennial, and it screams, I want to be a part of this movement. And it's been a joy to see. It's been something that I've been completely caught off guard by. I was asked to do 5 games last season before their commentator, Alan Green, could make it over. He was doing Champions League games. And I was absolutely blown away with the games at Bobby Dodd. But Mercedes-Benz has been a completely different story.
Yeah. I believe in the industry, the term used is they have a high Q rating.
Oh, really?
That's the term, yes.
Is that the term?
It's very professional. If you want to sound professional, that's what you would say.
By the way, if you're weighing up the resumes,
yeah.
Big Boy and Outkast destroy Waka Flocka. I mean, it's...
Oh, yeah, I would agree.
100%.
Yeah. I just want to make that known.
But they're all famous and cool.
Yeah. Absolutely. No, and he's dead right...
You know how uncool I am, though, JJ? I need to Google him. I need to, like, the state of me. And the other thing was, we were doing our final game in Toronto. And I have to ask the guys on the extra BN, like, what line should I use here? Joking. Because Migos come out to the games too. I mean, Migos are a fan. And they're from Atlanta. So there's loads of things. We were up in Toronto doing the game, and I said, so what's a good Drake line? And they were like, running riot through the six. And of course, I wanted to say something like, Atlanta, you know, running through the six. And Dan Gargan, my analyst, had to be like, no, you're saying it wrong. You're just saying it wrong, Kev. Don't do it.
You can't fake it. People will know. Kevin,
Kevin, you keep rocking Stankonia. That's all you need.
Hey, good stuff, Kevin. Should be a really fun one this weekend. What an atmosphere it'll be. We appreciate you giving us some time. Thanks, man.
Anytime. Cheers, gents. Take care.
Our thanks to Kevin Egan. This should be really fun. The atmosphere, like we said, is going to be just like among probably one of the most memorable scenes that we've seen.
I really hope there's a healthy traveling support from Portland.
Yeah, me
because
too.
There was trouble with the allocation of tickets for the SKC away game, and I heard there wasn't going to be a ton of, how should we put it, away fans.
Well, they should be there. I mean, they're a great fan base. Any fan base, they should have a right to watch their club play in a final, for sure. And they will be. Of course there will be Portland fans there, but the story is going to be the turnout for Atlanta. And it was interesting to hear Kevin talk about the way the city has just, like, gone head over heels for this, as has been the case really since their inception. For me, we talk so much about Martinez, Almiron, the attack. You almost forget Atlanta's back line is also really, really good. And I think that's kind of the secret ingredient.
I think it's really experienced as well. And Parkhurst, who was... Is this his fourth final? I mean, he's got...
I think it's his fifth he's in got, 9 years, something like that.
He hasn't won one yet, has he?
No, he has not. He was a finalist for Defender of the Year. He's a leader on that club. He's healthy. He had been dealing with, I think, an ankle injury. They've got Greg Garza back. It's just, you know, it's a very strong group. And I don't know. It's hard for me. I'm not saying that, like, you don't get weird results in this sport, but it's hard for me to envision a way right now that Atlanta don't win this game.
I'm looking for reasons to bet against them, and all I can come up with really is a Valerian Blanco masterclass.
Well, you're right, though. I mean, that is, like, Diego Valeri is still, he was, you know, before Joseph Martinez just won MVP, it was Valeri's. Like, he's still among the best players in the league. Obobese, that I talked about with Ross, has really exploded onto the scene. This young American, Blanco, oh my, the goal he scored against Kansas City. It should be fun. It really should be fun. Do you want to make a prediction?
I'm going to say 2-1 to Atlanta, which is probably being on the conservative side of the goals in an Atlanta win.
I'm going to go 3-0 Atlanta.
That's comprehensive.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So there you go. I can't wait for it. Should be fun. Saturday night, 8:00 on Fox. This one is. Let's see. We've got a quick look at Greg Berhalter and his introductory press conference, but... Up. Before we do that, JJ, I want to tell you about Indochino, some of the best menswear in the biz, quite frankly. Huge variety of fabrics, colors, patterns that make Indochino so stylish. It's no longer any excuse for wearing an ill-fitting suit, JJ, especially when they're available at such great prices. Highest quality stuff for the lowest price. Indochino is North America's leading made-to-measure menswear company. It makes suits and shirts to your exact measurements for an unparalleled fit and comfort. Now, here's how it works. You visit a stylist at their showroom and get your measurements taken, or you can do it at home by yourself and shop online at Indochino.com. Choose your fabric both inside and out. Choose your design customizations, submit your measurements with your choices, and then just sit, relax, and wait while your suit gets professionally tailored and mailed to you in just a couple of weeks. It's incredible how easy it is. Now, this week, listeners to this podcast can get any premium Indochino suit for just $359 at Indochino.com when entering Offside at checkout. That's 50% off the regular price for a made-to-measure premium suit. Plus, shipping is free. That's Indochino.com, promo code Offside for any premium suit, just $359 and free shipping. Incredible deal for a premium made-to-measure suit. So get on it, everybody. Like we said, Offside, no S at the end. JJ, the introductory press conference, actually for Greg Berhalter, wasn't that far from where you and I sit right now.
No, it was not.
On the west side, just a little more downtown. But yeah, I could almost seen it from here.
Yeah, and I don't think there was a ton to take out of it, but we've taken probably the most important parts.
Right, because everybody wants to know, well, what does this mean for the U.S.? How are they going to play? How are things going to be different? And Alexi Lalas stood up for all of us, like the hero that he is, and asked that question. I broke this down into a couple cuts for you from Berhalter. Here he is, first off, on the style of play.
The idea is that we're an attacking-based team that wants to create goal-scoring opportunities by disorganizing the opponent. It will do that in a number of different ways. What I'd say is, consistently over my time in Columbus, we've done it through build-up, right, where we start the ball with the goalie in the back, the teams try to press us, we play through them to create goal-scoring opportunities. We're making the field big.
Here's Berhalter continuing on using pressure to create chances.
Whether we start in a mid-block or move into high pressure to force turnovers, win the ball, and immediately create goal-scoring opportunities. But the idea is it's a fluid style that is the players are intent on breaking lines, playing through the opponent, and creating goal-scoring opportunities. I think, at times we can do a better job to change the tempo of the game instead of playing at such a high rhythm all the time. I think mixing that rhythm is going to be very important, especially at the international level, especially considering some of the climates you're playing in. But, we want to see ball circulation, breaking lines, creating goal scoring opportunities. That should be the DNA of this team.
Well, here we go.
Well, so it's a mixed bag. So he starts out, and let's address the first part where he talks about how he played at Columbus, which I'm presuming he's not going to even attempt to implement with the United States, where they play out from the back and play through the press.
What he said.
That is, if he can pull that off,
yeah,
I will doff my hat to him. I think he's a way better coach.
Well, then it means that, A, it would mean that these previous managers were wrong, and B, it would kind of mean that we were all wrong about these players.
And we are way better.
Than
way
what we
better
yeah.
than what we thought.
Right.
So you're going to see Zach Steffen rolling the ball out. The center halves will separate. You'll see Zach Steffen rolling the ball out to, we'll say, DeAndre Yedlin, and we'll begin from there, or to one of the center backs. And we're going to play through.
I'm a little nervous.
I don't see it. The second part of what he said, he's reading from the JJ Bible.
I know.
Is where we're going to have high pressure in certain areas of the field. Maybe sit off at certain points and pressurize in certain areas in attack. Absolutely, 100%, Greg, totally agree with you. It's a way to play. It's a way we can win and create chances. 100%. The first part, I'll tell you, I didn't roll my eyes. I felt a chill down my back. Even against moderate opposition, I don't see us doing that.
It's going to be fun, though. Aren't you like a little bit curious
I
to
am
see
excited.
Like, a new look? And like now we'll find out what these players are really capable of. He's talking about creating goal-scoring opportunities. How many times did he say it there?
Yeah.
Now, look, so for me, this was the part of the press conference that I cared about. All the other stuff now, like how they went about this process, I'm not saying that that stuff doesn't matter, but it's done. Like, we have the guy, so it's about winning now. And so when I heard those comments, I'll be honest, like my tail started wagging a little bit. Like I like what I heard. I know you did. I thought of you immediately when I heard his stuff about high press. It's all good. Goal scoring opportunities. I think He said all the right things.
He definitely
now,
did.
Now it's about implementing them and finding out if we're actually capable of doing them.
Now, the second part I think we're capable of. The first part leaves me and you a little bit concerned. The other sentence he had early on was where he talked about experience, bringing experienced players back into the fold. That's going to raise eyebrows. He is going to get the backs up of so many people when in the January camp Michael Bradley's involved, which he
will be.
Which he invariably will be.
And Josie will be. Yeah, oh, yeah.
Yeah. Other points to come out of it on the non Greg Berhalter side of things was Carlos Cordero, who said Jay Berhalter had nothing to do with coach selection. He did have something to do with the Ernie Stewart selection. So the elephant in the room is this massive conflict of interest, which they've created for themselves in this scenario. And Cordero went on to say, we got our best guy. We couldn't have moved any faster. So he addressed the amount of time it took to appoint Greg Berhalter. I don't think anybody really will be satisfied with that answer, but yeah, that's all you're getting. And the World Cup bid was the priority during the summer. So clearly getting a manager in was not the key. The key was to make sure we secured the 2026 World Cup.
I mean, do you feel like the U.S. are that much... Like, I was always okay with the time frame. I know some people were getting antsy. Why haven't they done anything yet? What are they waiting for? I don't. Does it feel like we're that far... much more like behind?
No, I said I didn't believe that a run of friendly games were, you know, for a year of friendlies was going to be detrimental to right. the team.
He's in time for the January camp. They'll have friendlies that'll all be leading up to the Gold Cup. Like, I think it's okay, everybody.
My sole issue was the execution of the process, because we were looking for transparency. We were looking for, I guess, an openness to new ideas and to interview the best candidates from as broad a range of candidates as possible, and we can't say we saw that. That would be my concern.
There were international teams that made World Cup managerial changes like on the eve of the tournament. I'm not even talking about Spain, but like, you know, was it Japan that changed managers really late on?
They were relatively late on going into, like, there was new managers installed for the World Cup with friendly games ahead of them.
Right. It's 2018. It's December of 2018. The next World Cup is in 4 years. Calm down, everybody.
I just want to make sure we've made the right call, not how long it took.
Right. That is 100% correct. A quick what to watch for, JJ. Premier League this weekend, 10 a.m. Manchester United and Fulham. I saw Claudio Ranieri. What did he refer to Mourinho as? My friendly friend?
Did he say that?
Something like
That's a very Ranieri. Did he
I was going to say, just to look at him is like you could see him saying that.
Did he say dilly dilly afterwards?
12:30 on Saturday, Chelsea and Manchester City. Chelsea, they lose to Spurs last weekend. They lose to Wolves this past midweek. And now it's Manchester City coming up at the weekend. This could compound what has become some problems for that club. Saturday, 2:45, Leicester City and Spurs. Serie A, an interesting one on Friday at 2:30. Juventus and Inter.
You can watch that on ESPN Plus.
Yeah. And, of course, JJ, MLS Cup Final, as we mentioned, Saturday, 8 o'clock p.m. Did want to mention, too, Copa Libertadores, for everybody who's been curious about that. Do you see Boca Juniors, when they were leaving in their buses, just like the incredible parade of fans surrounding the buses, and it was obviously a much different look the last time we saw them driving through in a bus.
I would just say, can everyone make their way to the airport themselves? Yeah. Let's get rid of
these
buses.
It was
buses.
Almost like the fans created like this caravan sort of like protect them.
A cordon sanitaire to make sure no one could get close to them.
But that is this weekend as well, Sunday at 2:30 in Madrid, because of course.
It's worth taking note that the Spanish police did intercept a Boca Juniors fan who was part of a ultras group, a rather unsavory character, and have deported him from Spain already.
All right. Well, there you go. Off to a good start for the police, honestly. Oh, let's see. We wind it down with...
Red card.
Would you like to go first?
I will. Okay. It's probably important to mention the Ballon d'Or debacle involving DJ Martin Solvig and his comment to the very first winner of the Women's Player of the Year and the Ballon d'Or, Ada Hegerberg. And it's a wonderful moment to win it, to be the first person to win it. It's just incredible. And so DJ Martin, he really had a sense of the occasion and how important it was for the women's game. So he asked this question.
Est-ce que tu sais twerker?
Non.
Now, that's been widely shown around, and the disgust of people has been... I don't think there's much else for us to say, except I didn't want to let it pass that we think that that is somehow
so
okay.
Incredibly, I don't know, it was just so...
It was so dumb.
Dumb, inappropriate.
Tone deaf.
Yeah.
And she's probably dreamt of this as a little girl, all the way to get to this amazing moment.
Who is he, by the way? I'm not familiar with him.
And the word... The letter's EDM, which is just okay. Makes me want to vomit.
All right.
He's a DJ. I'm sure he's great, but he wasn't very good at that. Anyway, that's not even my red card. My red card is Scott Arfield of Rangers, and it requires a Lampard and Gerrard watch.
Lampard and Gerrard, we're keeping an eye on you.
So we were talking about tackles earlier, Andrew, and Scotty Arfield, that old Canadian, he had a two-footed lunge on Hearts goalie Zednik Zamal at the weekend. It was an utterly brutal tackle, and it sounded a bit like this.
I don't understand why Scott Arfield's doing that. The goalkeeper has the ball. Perhaps he thinks, with the goalkeeper only having one hand on it, that he can go in and get it. But the rule is, if the goalkeeper has one hand on the ball on the ground, he's in control of it. That's the only reason I could think Scott Arfield thinks that he should be sliding in for that.
Well, I don't know what Andy Halliday is having a go at Bobby's Lamal for. There wasn't too much he could have done there, but Arfield is off. Rangers down to 10 men. Will that be a game changer?
It wasn't a great game changer. Rangers won, Andrew. And Stevie Gerrard's Jers climbed to the top of the table. Mm. But there was a fly in the ointment. Celtic didn't play at the weekend because Brendan Rodgers' side were showing tremendous character in their Scottish League Cup final win over Aberdeen. Well done to them. So Gerrard Rangers spent a grand total of 3 days atop the SPFL, but they lost to Aberdeen yesterday. Celtic drew with Motherwell. So now you think Celtic have gone top, but oh no! Rangers were not cast aside by their old firm rival. Kilmarnock are top of the SPFL.
Let them win.
By 1 point.
How amazing would it be?
Unbelievable, right?
Yeah. Oh. So do we have a title race in Scotland?
We do have a title race in Scotland.
Unbelievable. Almost unprecedented.
And there's an Old Firm derby on the 29th of December.
Nice.
So that is exciting. So that is my red card, Scott Arfield.
I like it. Let's see, JJ. My red card goes to Crystal Palace's kitchen. I'm reading now from Deadspin. All right. The United Kingdom's Food Standard Agency revealed that a training facility kitchen belonging to Premier League club Crystal Palace received a food hygiene rating of 0 out of a possible 5. The agency's website notes that the score means that, quote, urgent improvement is required in areas like food handling, cleanliness of facilities, and management of food safety. Part of the reason for the lowest possible rating was because inspectors discovered, quote, a significant mouse problem, unquote, that had apparently been ongoing for several months, according to a report obtained by Kent Live. The kitchen had to be closed for a few days as staff were ordered to clean up the mouse droppings and call in pest control. How does this happen? Like, this is a Premier League club. Look, I understand if, you know, you have a temporary mouse issue. There's food in the area. Like, it can happen. But for several months? That's amazing. The actual report stated this. You've been given a food hygiene rating of 0. This is because the conditions found at the time of inspection were unacceptable. Personally, I am disappointed as you have failed to ensure the safety of the food you are producing and feeding your staff. It is clear that you haven't managed the problem effectively, and the activity has been ongoing for several months. You agreed to voluntarily close the kitchen for a few days to address the matter. Appropriate treatment methods must be used to eliminate these pests.
I wouldn't mind, though. They have a live eagle at their games. Just let that boy, bad boy, loose in the kitchen. Could you imagine?
Amazing. That's a great point.
That's a tremendous point. Can I make one more point?
Yeah.
I still eat at a deli in Manhattan, which got a very unfavorable rating.
Yeah, I know. I'm the same way. If you find a hair in your food, do you ask for it sent back, or do you just take it out, hope no one sees, and just keep plowing right through?
If I love the sandwich enough, I'll keep going. If the sandwich is only average, it's going back.
I fight right through it.
Caught offsides, man of the match.
What do you got?
United States international striker Josh Sargent could make his first appearance for German side Werder Bremen after the club announced he will be included in the matchday squad against Fortuna on Friday. Sargent, 18, signed with Bremen in February 2018 but has not made a game day roster for the first team. He'll definitely be in the squad. He's earned it with his performances in training in recent weeks, says manager Florian Kohfeldt. The Missouri native, cue Grandpa Simpson,
I'll be deep in the cold, cold ground before I recognise Missouri,
has scored 7 goals and provided 2 assists in 12 matches with Werder Bremen 2, the club's reserve team. At international level, Sargent has scored 2 times in 6 appearances for the US since his May 2018 debut. Werder Bremen are in 9th place in the Bundesliga table with 18 points from 13 matches. So that is big. That is
it's big news.
It's great news. He's impressed when he's played for the national team. He's impressed with the reserve side. And he's impressed in training. And I'm excited because I've said it before. I'll say it again. I think he's the pick of our young bunch.
Wow. And define young bunch.
But below the Pulisics.
Okay.
So like the Hadji Wrights, the...
like McKinney, Adams?
The McKinneys, the Adams, and the Weas.
Now, let's just make it clear that if I had said that, you would have absolutely jumped me, no question about it, for having come to such a conclusion without him ever having played a senior team match. Not saying you're wrong to think what you're thinking, but I just want you to know that I'm on to you and your whole act, and I don't like it.
My whole act?
Yeah.
He played a senior international against a decent Peru team.
Oh, my God, the things you'd be saying if these words were coming out of my mouth.
I just like what I saw.
It always bothered me he's not in the military. I really would have loved him to be Sergeant. Let's see. My man of the match, JJ, is Joseph Martinez. We spoke about him a little bit earlier. Yeah, I know. What an outside-the-box choice. What am I thinking? The recipient of the MLS Landon Donovan Award. Miguel Almiron was a distant second, followed by Zlatan, Rooney, and Carlos Vela. Martinez, of course, set the new league record for goals in a season with 31. He scored 50 goals in his first 54 regular season games for Atlanta. He's the 8th South American to win the award. Diego Valeri, of course, won it just last year. They'll be facing one another this weekend. Now, you know how the award breaks down, right? There's a players' vote, club vote, and media vote, and then those three things are averaged together. I'm always interested, JJ, to see how the minds of players work in relation to the rest of us, like how they see things compared to how we see it. Luciano Acosta of DC United, he got less than 1% of the media vote and the club vote. But among players, he outvoted Wayne Rooney, Carlos Vela, and Bradley Wright Phillips. If you were a player, who would you like? I would think Luciano Acosta would see that and be like, you know what? Cool.
Oh, I'd love that.
Yeah.
To be respected that way by your peers, by the guys you play against.
Yeah.
But if you watch his performances, I know when Rooney came in, it seemed to spring him into life. But Rooney doesn't do what Rooney does without this guy in the team beside him. He was excellent. And I can imagine he was a nightmare to play against.
Their partnership was really fun to watch. And to see it for a full season next year, I think could be pretty fun as well.
It could.
Yep. So there you go. That is today's podcast. So you should be ready. Everyone should be ready now for MLS Cup 2018. I know I am. I assume you are. And it should be a lot of fun.
I'm excited. It's going to be great. I'm not concerned about that pitch at all.
I mean, it's not the first game played on that.
No. The atmosphere should be unbelievable.
Oh, yeah. No question about that. Hey, this was fun. To Kevin Egan, to Ross Smith, our thanks to both of them for getting us ready for that game. We'll be back, of course, next week with it's a big Champions League week. Like, this is it now. Here we go.
One of those European nights at Anfield.
Of course it is. They all are. Hey, to you I say...
Take you later, fun boy.
I'll see you.
Take care.
You've been listening to the Caught Offside Soccer Podcast.